I have a certain affinity for Celtic cultures. To me, they're sort of like underdogs. I guess it goes all the way back to the Dark Ages when the Angles and the Saxons came over from Europe and invaded Britain, and they pushed the people who lived there to the undesirable fringes of that island, and the Angles settled in what became Angleland, England, and the Celtic people, well, they live in the fringes, up in Scotland, over in Ireland, and Wales. The Welsh culture is about as Celtic as they come, but in the mind of a traveler, Wales generally plays second fiddle to its Celtic cousins in Ireland and Scotland. It's just not on their target from a travel point of view, and I think it should be. We're joined today by a friend of mine who's a tour guide from Wales, Martin Delandowitz, and we're going to talk about what's distinctive about Welsh culture. Martin, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Rick.
Give us a quick primer. How is Wales part of the UK, and what's its relationship with England and with its Celtic neighbours?
Right. Britain is a geographical term. It's an island. It comprises England, Wales, and Scotland. And Wales, it's on the west, it's on the left-hand side. In size, it's about the size of Delaware, or six Rhode Islands, and it has only 3 million people. So it's not very big, and it's not very prominent.
But legally, it's tighter to England than Scotland or Ireland.
The difference is that the King of Scotland, James VI of Scotland, became the King of England, James I. And that's a true marriage of kingdoms, a marriage of the crowns, whereas Wales was much more of a shotgun marriage, do you understand?
Okay, so yeah. Scotland got on board with the UK with a little bit of its terms
in
consideration, but Wales, it was just like it or leave it, and you can't really leave it.
That's right, yes.
Let's say you go into a pub, and there's an Irishman, a Scottish guy, and a Welshman at the bar. How would you know which guy's from where?
Well, it's a difficult one. And people think, oh, the Irishman will have red hair. There are more people with genetically the red-headed gene in Wales than there are in Ireland or in Scotland. The Welsh, I've said there are 3 million people. There are 9 million sheep in Wales. We have the highest proportion of sheep to people in the European Union. So when you walk into the bar, there'll be the Irishman and he'll be waving his shillelagh or whatever. There'll be the Scotsman wearing his kilt. Look for the man with three sheep. Because if there are 9 million sheep and 3 million people, everybody's got to have three sheep. So look for the man with the three sheep.
And coal, and you spend a lot of time in those dark mines.
Now, here we go. Coal. I will give you the Rhondda Valley in South Wales. And it was coal in the south. Where I come from, in the north, it was slate. The Rhondda Valley, 1851, fewer than 1,000 people lived in the Rhondda Valley. By 1901, so 1851 to 50 years, now there are 114,000 people living there and 115 coal mines. How many are there today? None.
So the late half of the 19th century, coal was a big deal in
Absolutely.
South Wales.
Yes.
A valley
yes.
north of Cardiff.
Yes, the valleys.
Okay, so you got sheep, you got coal, and that
yes.
was fueled by the Industrial Revolution.
Absolutely.
And then up in the north, you got slate.
Slate, and if you think of London, Liverpool, Birmingham, Manchester, all with their lovely Welsh slate roofs. Even Charleston in South Carolina was slated from Carnarvon, where I come
is
from.
Is that right?
It
so
is.
North Wales provided slate for many of the roofs beyond Britain, even.
Yes.
What's the deal with the Welsh culture and singing? Because I think of a Welshman as a choir man more than Scottish and Irish people.
So what I've just said about the Rhondda Valley is symptomatic or is emblematic, if you like, of the industrialization and the urbanization of Wales in the 1800s and early 1900s. But as I've said to you, the coal mines have now gone. And the male voice choir, men coming together to sing, is a product of industrialization and urbanization. Well, now, as I've said, that industry has gone. And I'm going to tell you the truth. I hate telling the truth. Few young people sing in male voice choirs today. You know, that methodistical, chapel-going, coal mine-working, tin bath in front of the fire, blackened coal, that's all gone. It's all in the past. It's a myth.
So for the younger generation, is that kind of settling with the old dead-end life of a mine worker and you just get some joy by singing and they would rather not succumb to that? Is that kind of the generational challenge?
Even when I was a kid, and I mean, I'm an old man, as you can see from across the table here, Rick. When I was a kid, it was the time of the Beatles.
Right.
And where I live, it's the most Welsh-speaking part of Wales. Okay. But it was considered hick in the time of the Beatles to speak Welsh. Huh. And equally today, you know, you can talk about Welsh pop music groups, and that's what the younger people go for. They go for the, you know, the Welsh culture. Yes, and it is Welsh, and it's individual. But at the same time, it's almost part of a larger Western European culture.
Okay, so Wales would probably embrace this whole European Union ethic of let's all celebrate and make a giant mixed salad.
Parts of Wales.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with Martin Delandowitz, and Martin is a friend and fellow tour guide from the north of Wales. We're talking about Welsh culture, and there's so much happening for travelers to Britain these days. And Martin, one thing that we were talking about just a second ago, which is kind of disconcerting to me, because a big joy of traveling in Wales is going to the choir practices. In any town, in the old days anyways, Tuesday or Wednesday or Thursday in this or that town would be church choir practice night. And then the choir would go over to the pub across the street from the church, and they'd have a few pints, and they'd keep singing, and tourists were welcome to sit in a circle and drink beer and sing with them. Is that still happening, or is that something that's fading away, to be honest?
Well, to be honest, it's fading away. A French friend of mine who wanted to send French visitors over to Wales, he said, find a place in the Carnarvon area where you can sing in pubs. And I walked into a pub, I have done that before, and I said to some truly local people, I said, in Welsh, because that's what we speak, where do they do singing in pubs? Everybody stared and said, good gosh, they suddenly realised we don't do it anymore. Now, the choir still exists, and they do still practice, and they do go into pubs. But it's not, it's almost as if in this modern way, we've given over public singing to the more professional people rather than enjoying it ourselves, you know.
So the choirs are still there, but it's more of a straightforward, okay, we practice, we perform, we go home.
And don't forget that Welsh is a great centre for modern music too, so that it's a changing scene. It's a changing scene. The language is what, where I live, holds it together, do you know?
Holds the community together?
Yeah, it's cement. A lot of the other sort of stereotypical things that Welsh people are supposed to do are things of the past.
That's sort of counterintuitive. You'd think the language would be left aside as people would just embrace the big language of English, but the language remains relatively strong.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, where I live, over 95% use it for all day and every day.
And this is in North Wales?
This is in Northwest Wales.
People speaking Welsh. And if a tourist comes in, they may be oblivious to that because the local people will turn to the tourist and speak English.
Yes.
When the tourist is not there, it's Welsh. And as I well know from talking to you for so long, in heaven, they speak Welsh.
That's right. In heaven, they do speak Welsh.
So the language, is it something that the government pushes, or is this an indigenous natural yearning to have their own language? Who's pushing the not only the survival, but the growth of the old Welsh language in an island that is predominantly English?
Right. I live in the northwest of Wales. It rains twice as much as it does, say, in London. The wind blows constantly. It is beautiful. I mean, you've been there, Rick. It is so beautiful, but it doesn't do you many favours. So if you live there, you've got to want to live there. And that's a great social cement. We think it's fine. We like it. We enjoy it. The other thing is that because it's, let's say, unforgiving, not many people come. So we've only got each other to speak to. So we speak Welsh. The other thing
that's
that people,
very logical, I guess.
It is.
It's such a godforsaken corner that the people who stay there really want to be there.
It is God, and they do want
godforsaken in a nice way.
In a nice way. It's you know, to our post-romantic eyes, it is drop-dead gorgeous. The other thing is Scots Gaelic. 1% of the Scottish population speaks Scots Gaelic. Irish. 1% of the Irish population speaks Irish. 20% of the whole population of Wales speaks Welsh. 95% plus, 96, 97, where I live. And of the Celtic languages spoken in the British Isles, it is that most spoken. Because good Queen Elizabeth I, God bless her, had the Bible translated into Welsh. And so by the 1580s, we had an orthodox, an authorized version of our language that was an exemplar.
In the 1570s?
1580s.
1580s.
Yes. 88, I think, yeah.
And it's still used today? I mean,
you have
the King James Version in England, you got the Martin Luther Version in Germany, and you got the
Queen Elizabeth Version. It is archaic, but that throughout the centuries, people would say, well, this is our language. It is written down. The Queen and subsequent kings, this is their version of our language.
Is the Welsh language, how do you demonstrate what it sounds like to somebody like many of us who've never heard it before?
Well, I would say, and I'm going to speak proper Welsh, not as politicians speak it. Well, dan yn eisteddon fy ma, Rick Borema, and dan yn siarad efo'i gilydd ar y radio. We're sitting here today, Rick, together, and we're talking with one another on the radio. And that's what it sounds like. And people often think, oh, it's a dialect of English. No, it is not. Pan dyn ni'n siarad y Gymraeg, dyn ni'n siarad yn hollol wahanol o beth mae'n Saeson yn siarad.
What did he just say?
When we speak Welsh, we speak totally different to the English speak.
There's no risk of that not happening. What's a key phrase I should know as a traveller in Wales?
Well, the catch-all word is iawn, spelt I-A-W-N, I-A-W-N, iawn. Just say iawn.
Iawn.
Iawn. Now, iawn is, I'm walking down the street, I meet you, and I will hold up my thumb in the affirmative, and I say, iawn, are you okay? And you'll put up your thumb and go, iawn, reply.
Hey, I like it. Let's try it.
Yawn!
Yawn. I'm there. I'm in Carnarvon.
Yeah, that's right.
I see you walking down the street. Is there a certain place that a traveller could go to best find the celebration of traditional Welsh language and culture?
Just south of where I live, I believe. I went with you there, Rick. There is the Welsh Language Learning Centre, the National Welsh Language Learning Centre, which is an old granite quarry in town, isolated, with the sea in front and the hill behind. So no phone signal, no TV signal, nothing. And you can go there and do full courses in the Welsh language. It's a beautiful location.
What town is that in?
Llanelheirn.
That's the double L. If you see the double L, that's
yes.
A... That's the biggest bugaboo when a traveller is trying to read a road sign or something. They see a double L. Pronounce that again.
It's S. You have to do it down to the one side of your mouth. S. Put the tip of the tongue on the roof of your mouth, just behind and touching the front teeth, and expel S.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. I'm speaking with Martin Dlandovic. And we're talking Welsh culture. Our phone number is 877-333-7425, and John is calling in from Cleveland. John, thanks for your call.
Yes, so I'm going to be traveling to Wales with my family this year. My son is only 8 months. He'll be about a year when we travel, and I'm wondering if there are any little kid-friendly ways to experience Welsh culture. Specifically, my wife is going to be at an artist residency in Corris. So I'm not completely familiar with the geography, but I know it's somewhere in the northwest in between where you are and Snowdonia National Park. So I'm just looking for some general recommendations along those lines.
Well, do you know, in that area, Snowdonia National Park, so you've got mountains. They're not big mountains, but they're the biggest we've got, so you just have to stick with those. And lots of lovely walks. And then 20 minutes from the mountains, you're at the seaside. One of the things that I used to take my kids to, I have two daughters there, they're old and in their 20s now, over on Anglesey, which if you're in Snowdonia, it's only 45 minutes. The sea zoo, you know, it's just all native wildlife.
And the sea zoo?
The sea zoo, and they got all the, you know, all the fish and things that you see. And my kids used to love that. And just messing around in those beaches, go and look in the rock pools, and then you can find the little crabs and so on yourself. The slate industry up in the mountains by Llanberis produces some really weird environments. You know, these great holes that were carved out of the mountain and now are just so silent and so nowadays often full of water. So there's that lovely blend of the mountain and the sea, all within half an hour of one another. So for a kid, oh, it's wonderful sights, beautiful sights.
When I was thinking of John's question about with a small child things to do in North Wales, there's a garden. What's the famous garden?
Oh, Bodnant.
Bodnant Garden is just a glorious natural. It's like a giant, somebody's lovely yard to play in. There's a steam train, which kids who like steam trains. Isn't there a famous one that goes up Mount Snowdon?
There's one that goes up Snowdon, then right. There's one that goes from Carnarvon to Porthmadog.
And these are narrow gauge?
Yeah, narrow gauge, 1 foot 11
and
a quarter.
And they still,
yeah, that's right.
Steam, and it just takes you back 100 years. And there's that Coney Island resort that Americans don't even know about, just next to Conway.
Oh, Llandudno.
Llandudno. It's got a pier you can go out and you can get the candy floss, which is cotton candy and caramel-covered apples and all sorts of really fun traditions that just kids go wild. And if you want to give your kid a little medieval history education, the town of Conway has that wonderful old house, which is, you go through there and it's like you stepped into somebody's house. Oh, down on the pier, there's all the other kids catching crabs, all the parents bring their kids down to the pier head.
To catch crabs.
And they've got all their gear, and it's so simple. And they're just yanking in the crabs and torturing them and then
letting them go. If the parent is happy, the child is happy, and vice versa.
Hey, there you go, John. Does that help you?
That sounds great. Thank you so much.
All right. Have a good time.
Thanks.
Welsh native son Martin Dlandovic is with us on Travel with Rick Steves. He's sharing what it means to be Welsh and offering advice on how visitors can enjoy a real taste of Wales today. We're at 877-333-7425, and you can reach us by email at radio@ricksteves.com. Joanne's calling from Seattle. Hi, Joanne. Thanks for your call.
Hi, Rick. Hi, Martin.
Hello.
Yes, my family surname is, and I'll massacre the pronunciation, but it's Llewellyn.
Yeah.
And we, of course, assume because of our last name that we're a direct descendant of the last Prince of Wales that was from Wales.
Yeah.
But we would love to go back and dig a little further into our genealogy. And the most that we've ascertained is kind of in the Aberdare, Powys area, that kind of thing. But we'd love to know if we really wanted to go and dig into the history of Llewellyn ap Iorwerth. Is that how you pronounce
yeah,
it?
Yeah, Llewellyn ap Iorwerth. Llewellyn ap Gruffydd was the last, as it were.
Yes. So if we wanted to go and really dig into that history and see the castles, the battlefields, maybe cemeteries, that kind of thing, what would you suggest as a basic little itinerary?
Right. Firstly, digging into your past, the lovely Watchtower Press has produced a wonderful book called A List of Migrants from Wales to the United States of America. It is in 4 volumes and there's an index volume. The research on that book is meticulous. You have to go to a very good library to get it. Maybe it's online. And if it is known, demonstrable, or provable, it's in that book. So don't waste your money sending some professional genealogist to find your ancestry. If it's in that book, it's provable. Secondly, Wales has, and I'm talking about castles now. I'm not talking about, ooh, look at that, isn't it a nice castle? If you're really into castles, Wales is the place to go. South Wales, Chepstow, the oldest stone-built castle in Britain, Pembroke, birthplace of Henry VII, and so on. North Wales, those great castles built by Edward I, fantastic. And so that if you're into that historical thing, North or South Wales, and, you know, I'm from North Wales, and I would tell you, and Rick will tell you, beautiful place. South Wales, beautiful place. So there is more than enough choice. North or South. Middle is a little intractable. An upland plateau cut by deep, steep valleys.
There you go, Joanne. I hope that gives you some good ideas.
Definitely. Thank you so much.
Happy travels. Thanks for your call.
Enjoy yourself, Joanne.
Bye.
Bye.
Martin, this is so fun talking about Wales. And let's just close it with, you're traveling around the United States now. When you get back home and you get to your hometown, you drop in the pub, what are you going to hear? What are you going to smell? Who are you going to see?
I see people that I know. And do you know, very sociable scene, the pub scene. Wales is right up there, so that going to the pub isn't a matter of drinking. It's a matter of social interaction. It's not, there's nothing like the British pub atmosphere. And Welsh is peculiarly Welsh. And you go into pubs and you speak Welsh.
So when you go home, that's the way you can reconnect with your community. You know you'll have people you can talk with. There's a conviviality in the pub. You're not going there for a gastronomic experience. You can fill the tank.
Food's good. No, food is good. Yep. What do people eat? We eat soups and stews. And because we've got lots of sheep, we
eat so soups and stews, speak a little Gaelic and check in with your neighbors.
Absolutely. Right.
Martin Delandowitz, you make me want to go back to Wales. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Rick.
Another destination that can teach us a lot about what it takes to live together is Bosnia-Herzegovina. Guides from Bosnia join us next to take your calls at 877-333-7425 and tell us what you'll find in their country on the Balkan Peninsula. You're listening to Travel with Rick Steves.
Thank you.